nine new 180s and one new 185, and involved all of these airplanes in my alley. And with the exception of the 185 that blew away in the wind on Mount Hayes, did we get a Mount Hayes story?
No.
Well, why don't I do it?
Well, you can't either that or...
Why don't you do it? Do it on. Do it when you get back though,
okay.
On your own tape.
Cause wait, then, I write this down.
Write it down. Yeah. We didn't get anything like that.
Well, here.
There's another thing, Don. Any time that you run into a situation where you ding up an airplane, anything that comes back to your mind, you know, any landing where you had problems or engine trouble or whatever, you know, it may never even use it, you know, but it's nice to stick it in.
Oh yeah.
See, you know, just to break the story up a little bit. Mm-hmm. Okay, but give me that Mount Hayes story, definitely.
Well, it wouldn't take long.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Let's see, where are we? Street airplanes. Okay, the Cub you've got now, I think you said you've owned for 16 years or something?
No, 10 years.
10 years.
63 months.
And how many engines are you there?
Well, it's 2,500 hours, and don't have a mark on it. And I've always flown it on small wheels. Or retractable ski.
This is the original engine, isn't it?
Yeah. But I have two majors.
Two majors, so you got about $5,000.
No. That was total time airplane and engine.
Oh, I see.
$2,500.
$2,500.
I majored it, I had air power, majored at 500 and at 1500.
You don't obviously let them run anywhere near to where
they're... No. Well, this last run was 1,000 hours.
Because they're rated at 2,000 or something.
Well, this is... I run it 1,000 hours.
Yeah.
Since the last major.
Yeah.
But, see if you fly these things at sea level, I know. It's critical.
Yeah, right.
But the thing won't climb over
right.
McKinley with the passenger, then you have to change engines.
Yeah. I got to put that in. That's great. Okay. Oh, what about that woman at Cantwell? Remember you were telling me about a woman that you picked up and she got squirrely and started pulling.
Yeah,
how did that happen?
Well, one of those calls I get all the time to run somebody to the hospital.
She was going to the hospital?
Well, that's what they said.
In Anchorage?
So I went up there to pick her up and she looked a little bit wild. So I just sat in the front seat and took off, and that was a mistake.
Yeah.
Because she went eight in the middle of the takeoff, and we went over the Summit Bank out there.
Ooh.
And we were throwing rocks and dirt 40 feet in the air, and I finally got stopped between a couple of posts without wrecking anything, luckily. And I looked at her, and she was just wild.
Yeah.
And gurgling and clawing and throwing her fit. I shut everything down, drug her out. And they chased us with a couple of trucks and said, what happened? Well, they said, I need some help here. So this guy and his wife said, we'll help you. So then we made a mistake. This was a Pacer, a Piper Pacer, which has a door.
Tricycle gear?
No, it's a conventional gear Pacer. And, so I set the guy's wife in front and put the husband in the back, right behind the wife, and that was a mistake. We should have put the nutty gal between
in the back
the wall and put him by the door, because everything went fine. She was docile and well behaved until we got about 6,000 feet high. And there was a good tailwind, 6,000 feet. So we were roaring along there, and she just went ape again. And she all but got out of the airplane.
Oh.
Just one leg was all this guy had to hang on to.
Holy man.
Tremendous pressure against the door. You can get out, but you can't get
in
because
right.
it traps you like a bear traps you. So I slowed the plane down, got the flaps out, and cut the gal all up, trying to get her back in. We finally got her back in, and then I landed Talkeetna and there's blood all over the place. Cut her legs tremendously on that door. She's bleeding all over. And wild all the way. Just wild. And then I called Tom Peaton and told him to get a set of handcuffs.
Huh.
And there was a commissioner there, Peter Musgrove. She brought up her handcuffs.
Woman commissioner?
Yeah. I had her, Gallen took her on in and had the cops meet us.
Huh.
Yeah.
FBI decided.
Yeah. Wow. That'd be enough to make you want to take dual controls out of your airplane. Do you leave the duals in, or have duals
I'll
in?
I'll tell you why. Because I get to run in these days and nights through one another, and after two or three days and a night or two, you can fire right when you're awake, but it's a big job when you're asleep.
So. Yeah.
And I pick out somebody that looks like they're awake, and let them do some of the flying while you catch a little snooze. I used to do that quite often. Construction crews coming in Fairbanks.
Yeah.
Five road jobs down there one time between here and Anchorage. They had radios and all the cameras.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, until Fairbanks Air Service caught on, it was a lucrative deal.
Oh, yeah.
And they run a daily schedule and they screwed everybody up and went broke themselves.
Huh.
On a flat rate fare. But the thing was, I take Roberta with me. She can fly.
Oh, yeah.
She got a real nice job.
Did she ever get a private ticket, or did she? I know she sold it.
No, she said she got, 20 or 25 hours to a J&G. But, man, she should have a problem. But anyway, we was heading back about 3 in the morning or 4 in the morning, heading back into Talkeetna. We were delivering four of these construction types to Fairbanks. And she said, wake up, I'm lost, we're in the fog. And
this is Roberta?
Yeah.
Oh,
geez. So I brought her along to fly the plane back while I slept. Private air, running two or three days in the end, a night or two. You just get some beach, you can't stay awake. So anyway, first thing I did, I turned the ABF on. And it pointed at 180 degrees. I said, oh boy, that's something. I must be almost ready to crash into McKinley.
Yeah.
Because if obviously,
if
it's pointing away from
you, right.
Back of you, you're apparently
stations on your
ready
tail.
To hit something in the mountain area, right? That's what I thought, so I cranked it around. Called Summit, and at that time, it was having a 24-hour watch schedule. And they had a 2,000-foot overcast, and we come for room and down to there. You know, you're supposed to, the mean clearance altitude there at Summit's about 6,000 feet. Anyway, we got back down under, and it would wake me up. I didn't have any trouble.
Yeah, you didn't have any trouble staying awake after that. Hey, I'll tell you, why don't we go out and grab a bite to eat? She's ready to go.
Yeah. Okay. Now, where the heck were we? We talked about scattering the energy. Planes you're going to camp. Okay. What about the baby that was born in the airplane?
Well, strange enough, that was from the same area. Always, these propositions take place on black, owly nights and high winds and overcast and snow and storm conditions. This was that kind of a night. A call came in to rush to a place called Cantwell and see if we could beat the stork to the hospital. So I immediately left for Cantwell, and sure enough, when I arrived, a whole group of the residents of Cantwell were trying to assist this late labor case into the airplane, and we took off immediately and got about 80 or 90 miles, and we lost the battle of the stork. The child was born in the airplane, and I'm allergic to screaming women anyway, and this was the first child.
Oh,
And it was quite an ordeal, to say the very least.
Yeah, I imagine.
Yeah. Anyway, I called Summit Radio, and they relayed some information back to me. And the information was to tie the cord. And I said that the air was so turbulent I couldn't hardly hang on to the airplane. So I asked them if it'd be all right if we left the cord untied till we got the anchorage, and if they'd please have an ambulance down there so they could do all the honors if and when we got to anchorage.
Yeah.
And we finally got the anchorage all right, and we was met by plenty of personnel that knew how to tie fancy bowline knots and cords, and all went well for 3 weeks, 2 weeks rather. And the mother and child were doing fine, and they returned via train to Kentwell. And 1 week later, the small youngster caught the fatal case of pneumonia. After he went back to the village of Kentwell. But anyway,
nothing to do with being born on the airplane.
No, but he survived the airplane ride, but he didn't survive the rigors of the Cantwell climate.
Okay. Now, how about your knee, Don? How did you ding up your knee?
Well,
I heard somebody said your lug
destroyed both knees. I've packed mountain sheep off Wrangell Mountains and up in the Iron Mountains.
Just a progressive thing, or did you do it?
Yeah, well, you see, football, it's commonly known as a set of football knees. Now, you can get them playing football or carrying heavy packs. I got both of my packing. And when you're young and full of vinegar, you think you can carry anything. And you're only allowed one issue of the material. It separates the major joints of your knee. And when this cartilage wears out, there is no more. And it's non-replenishing.
Right.
And I went to Dr. Mills, the great specialist in bones, and I said, X-ray these knees, they're wiping me out. And he said, fine. So he looked at the X-rays, and he said, shook his head, and he says, you've got enough cartilage floating around in the left knee to start a glute back to you. By the way, what did you do to the right one? Well, I said the same thing, only I probably stepped harder on the left one. Well, anyway, he says, well, what are your plans? Are you going to become a cripple? Continue to carry these loads? And I told him, I said, would it be okay if I just tripled the price of the sheep hunt?
Yeah.
And he said, that's all I can do for you. You get out of here.
Yeah.
What day
and what year were you born?
Your birthday? 11/21/21. Jubilee.
Okay. Now, what's the history? When I was listening to Brad Washburn's tapes, he told me that he thought, as a result of you and he flying up to his survey site on the bench at the head of the Ruth Glacier, where your mountain house now stands, that as a result of your activities there with him, that you got the idea for the mountain house.
Well,
he at the time said that he made the statement, what a wonderful place to bring tourists for a picnic.
Yeah.
And he said he wasn't sure, though, and that I should ask you about it.
Well, I looked over all quadrants of the whole range for a perennial landing place throughout the summer. You'll notice that that's on a north, sheltered away from a sun that strikes it in the south. It's in the shelter of the high granite spires to the south. And therefore, the powder snow lasts practically all day on a fresh snow, even in the hottest day of the summer. At the 6 to 10,000 foot level. And also, there's a permanent anchor ice glacier, ancient ice anchored there, and it offers a good ski landing throughout any season.
He said it was good year round to land there.
Right. The main thing is that it's the best and most spectacular view of McKinley from any quadrant. See, I had the opportunity during that time and since then to look over all the possibilities. Actually, there's five potential ski areas on, around, and on the various quadrants of McKinley. This particular location is the best because it's above the freezing level. Freezing level on any day but a hot summer day is usually around 5,000 feet. This is about 6,000 feet. Therefore, you have powder snow. Most of the itinerant tourists would like to go.
Yeah.
Land on a glacier, take a picture, and be on their way. Some of them would like to stay a month. Some of them have stayed a month, unintentionally.
Yeah.
We get up there and get stuck in the weather. But the weather has no duplicates. July 1 year ago, only one day out of the 31 was McKinley not a flyable operation for high altitude sightseeing and reconnaissance. But usually, it's about a 60% deal where you can have 60% negotiable mountain weather, either due to cloud cover or standing wave activity and turbulence, and 40% when you shouldn't be in there or near it.
Okay. Now, next question. You think it'll be possible to arrange for me to hire your airplane
to go to the mountain house?
Take my wife up there.
Why not?
And spend the night on our anniversary.
Well, why not? When's the anniversary?
22nd of December.
Not this
year. This year.
See, I've got a brand new engine, no problem.
Yeah.
Listen, we can throw that in on the deal. Furthermore, how about, look.
All we want to do, you know, like is drive it out, keep it, leave early out in the morning so that we get there at the time you think we should get there to fly up there.
Yeah.
Fly up, take our heavy down sleeping bag with us, you know, something good to eat for dinner, and just spend the evening there, you know.
You know what I used to do would be to check Tyro's weather scan, and for 10 years, that was, I can still get the information from the RCC, and they know the trends, the pressure trends, the cloud covers, the winds, and the whole ball of wax, and mountain wave activity. See, if clear weather prevails, over about 3 days you get mountain wave and clear turbulence. You don't need that. But if, on the other hand, it snowed for 3 days, that's a consideration.
Yeah, right.
But here's the trick. It works every time. If you can get in there at the break of the storm, likely there will be a moderation of temperature, and probably you won't get caught by another storm
for a couple of days.
For a day or something.
Yeah.
But anyway, we can study the weather up there. And
let's see what she looks like. Maybe even for this year.
Besides, we'll put in an HF radio.
Yeah.
There,
let's see what. Let's see. Is this too short notice, the 22nd of December?
Ooh.
No.
No.
We'll do it.
Huh?
I'd love to go up there.
Yeah, just get you one of your, get the Alpenglow. Boy, say this summer, we...
Alpenglow.
Alpenglow. That's a gold peak. In the,
oh, yeah, yeah. From the
gold peak in the bronze of the sunset sunrise.
See that comet?
Well, no.
Have you seen that thing yet?
No, I didn't see
it. We saw it one night. Boy, that's spectacular.
Ooh,
Jesus, it's got a...
hail on it, and it was coming. We took, it was 6:15 one evening we came home, and it was coming right over here across the front.
Yeah.
Moving along, and man, was that thing going. It was moving just about this fast on the horizon.
Yeah.
Jeez, that thing was going. Great big long tail on it.
Got a good look at it.
Yeah, huh? Just the one night. Well, what would a guy have to take up there for gear then?
Outside gear.
Real warm clothes and warm
windbreaker.
Yeah.
Then you wouldn't need them.
Yeah.
But if you don't take them, you might need them.
Yeah.
Oh, snowshoes.
Yeah. Is there a heat up there?
Oh, yeah. I have dried birch to burn in the hibachi. You know that nice warm picture in that one magazine or one book?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Where it's comfy and it's insulated.
Yeah.
And stick a birch and you can heat that thing up to where you have to open the windows.
Yeah.
There you go.
21 years.
21 years?
20
years. Really?
Yeah.
You're talking about your birthday.
Right? You wouldn't believe that.
Nah.
I was only 9 when I got married.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll keep an eye on it then. We'll figure on doing that. We'll just leave you to figure the weather.
And
she looks good while we're moving.
No problem. Short day of the year.
Yeah. Other famous.
Oh, no, wait. It gets six minutes longer.
Yeah.
One minute longer the next day.
Okay. Other famous bush pilots. The biggies. Have you known any of them personally?
Oh, golly, I know most of them.
I mean, like Crossman.
Yeah. Crossman was Pan American executive,
right.
And he went to Seattle in the head office, and he had a heart attack at the age of 44 down there. But Gillum and Crossman and the old 97W, the Flying Cowboy, used to fly McGrath, and those guys were all really active about 38. I got
right.
38. They were really active.
Radabaugh.
Yeah. Jimmy, he was a little earlier and in this area.
And I also, of course, he was 27.
Yeah. But 38, they were really rolling. Oh, Peterson, North Consolidate, was flying up a storm. And Chris Christensen. He even come up and flew some of our little birds.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And
Haka.
Chris, he used to fly the war. And,
did you know that Roy Holm by any chance?
No.
Did you read that in the paper? Where the guy, he just retired from Pan Am. He had $30,000.
Yeah.
6 years old. Retired. He was an old bush pilot up here.
Sure.
He worked for Pan Alaska.
I was over there at McGrath.
Pan American
had Pan American Shack on the west side of the the east west runway. It was about 1,500 feet going. And all the old 211W. Winchell. Oscar Winchell.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh,
he used to see red airplane.
Okay.
And Schultz, of course, he was a kind of a new timer, but he was flying up a storm. I got a picture of a Waco. You know that one? Did you see the one? No, it's a Blanca over the Mediterranean, 41. Had a good picture of Schultz's mail plate.
Talking about pictures, Doc, one time you mentioned that you got a picture of you.
I don't know, were you carrying Baptiste? Yeah.
Can you see the airplane on the picture?
Well, I carried him out of the airplane down at Merrill Field. Some guy had to take a picture of him.
You see the airplane?
I don't know. I think you might be able to. I'll try to
look. That would be a good one that we might want to include for the dust jacket. That's the type of picture they're going to want.
Listen,
bang.
Yeah. What kind of a name do you think I'm coming to?
I don't know. That's almost their prerogative.
Yeah.
come, but what do you think?
I don't know. I hope they don't give it, I'll be perfectly honest with you, that wonderful book at Glacier Foundation. I hope they give it a better title than Glacier Foundation.
That's a good title.
Yeah, but it's kind of, it doesn't do much,
well,
you know.
It's
got a, nowadays, well, I'll tell you, people are a little more sophisticated. They want something a little more pizzazz to it, you know.
Well,
whatever it'll be, I don't know. But, see, they know what's going to
go a long ways.
They know.
Get a title as good as that.
Well, yeah, it tells you what the book is. Of course, you
can't
have anything about Glacier piloting anymore because that book.
No.
But they'll come up
but
with
listen,
something. They know what'll sell.
Yes, 63, about May of 63, the Anchorage Times has a picture of that too in there.
With you carrying it?
Yeah.
One of these times, you know, I'm going to go down to Anchorage and I'm going to go through their morgue down there. They're going to pick the morgue.
You can speed off the Anchorage.
That?
No, that I'm talking about Canelli.
And
on the Cassin's crew.
Batkin
come out feet first.
Yeah.
No, I didn't carry Batkin.
Well, this was like
Canelli.
What was this other one?
Well, he was part of the 9-man Cassin crew. I haul all them out.
There's nothing about that on the tape.
Well, Jesus.
I've got a description of the Cassin climb where Cassin froze his hands.
Oh, and the feet
went
the
up
faces.
And came back down, but I didn't. There was nothing about.
Oh, yeah. See, I met him.
A guy losing his hands, feet.
Oh, yeah. Canelli. They're a great athlete.
Maybe you could, in addition to that Mount Hayes thing, don't forget to put that on tape. Maybe you could stick something about a little more information on the Cassin climb on tape.
Well, see, I've been watching them come down, and they're moving just inches a day. And finally, when the first guy got to 11,000 feet, I snatched him out of the base of the south face. And then the rest of them, it came down, just moved, dragged slowly down over the seracs and crevasses, and they'd get to someplace I could pick them up. I got all of them before they got to 9,800 feet. All of them. But you should have saw what they came down. And their hands were frozen.
Well, there was fixed lines.
Like hams.
Where they left their lines.
Well, they left their fixed lines, but boy, you have to be nimble to pound in fresh lines. They went more than 4,000 feet straight up after they froze their hands.
You never did, I think I asked you one time, you don't know how much the wager was.
No, but Cassin will know.
Yeah.
If he'll tell us, I'm sure he might.
Okay, I already got the answer to that. When did you hear of a deep Bob Reeves? Any drinks next? We all said on that. Don't forget that Mount Hayes. Okay. Something that I've got to put in, not put in the book in dollars and cents or anything like that, but I've got to be able to indicate somehow how the ownership of Talkeetna Air Service transferred over into your name.
$50,000 plus 3% interest is how it transferred
over. Right, I know. But I mean, originally, first of all, Morrison held most of it.
Well, no, Morrison didn't. Well, wait. You have a tape on the fishing expedition with the two gas boxes full of rainbows. Okay.
He bought the planes then?
No, he would put a down payment on the plane.
Right, and then you'd take it down.
And then I'd get a contract. You see, the Denali Highway was not built at that time
right.
In 49. See, in 48 was when I met Morrison. And he decided, he said he wanted to, where did you get those big rainbow trout? Tremendous monsters, just fit in the gas box. It came right from the mouth of Talk of Bear Lake,
yeah,
to be exact. But anyway, I told him I wouldn't tell him, but I'd show him. And if he could be ready in 20 minutes, he could ride back because the trip in had been paid for. He said, fine. So up spring the laundry truck, and out come Morrison with all kinds of fishing tackle. And a while look in his eye, and he said, let's go. So we went up there, and the fish were still striking. Unconsciously, and he'd never seen anything like it. And he said, the reason I came to Alaska was to go fishing. But the minor reason was to come up and collect $10,000.
Yeah, right, for that laundry deal.
Yeah, you had that. Okay. So he immediately sold the laundry and moved to Talkeetna. And then he bought the Bucket of Blood, the scene of the holiday Mexican style. Okay. And then he would say, what kind of a plane will take off on floats quickest? All of your floats.
Well, now, prior to when he was doing this, though, did he have used...
As I was writing, a lot of other things I thought about that I'm going to need later on, and they're just a general bunch of stuff. Okay, we'll talk about the contract after a while when Kyan get here, so I won't make any... We won't talk about that now. Okay. When I wrote the description of the Loshi rainbow trout incident on the Talkeetna River, okay, whatever happened to the third guy? Now, when you started telling me about it,
wait,
he just disappeared.
You
picked the woman up out on the river, the big nude woman, and got her back to Talkeetna, and then she bought drinks all around. And
the third member... arrived after Loshi came into the old CA station.
Yeah. He walked in.
Yeah, he made his way. He had been watching.
And Loshi didn't know where he was. I mean,
well, as I recall, he thought he'd lost a boat.
Yeah, right. That's what you said on the tape.
Now,
he's still around.
We could ask.
He walked out the same night.
Well, see, it was only an accident that I came back at 3 in the morning from this circus, or
right.
2 or 3 in the morning.
Well, I wrote that thing up in a kind of a semi-humorous way, you know.
Yeah, well, sure, it had to be.
But I had to do that all the way through. So what I did, I, in a way, didn't make light of the airplane accident, Joe, but I described it, I didn't, you know, get all involved making it sound like a big hairy thing. In other words, he wiped the airplane out, obviously.
Well, the thing was, see, there was a lot of reservation a cautious note when the big gal asked Loshi. She said, honey, she said, I can't get my belt buckled.
Yeah.
And he said, no problem. This is going to be a smooth takeoff.
Oh, jeez. I wish I'd have had that in there.
Well, put it in.
Yeah, I will. I wonder if I should use Loshi's name.
What? Call him and ask him. Say, are you having
a
signed release?
That's it. So you got to have a signed release for that.
Yeah.
Because,
but wait,
you know,
they always get me the signed releases on their TV stuff. And on Ice Palace and on the Sourdough Story and on High Adventure and Bold Adventure.
Yeah.
And that whole bunch,
the
various, they always get you to sign a release. It might not be a bad idea.
Yeah, well, I can call him. He's here in town, of course.
Well, yeah, that'd be a good deal, because that is what went on. That's what the gal told me. She said,
Jesus.
So 7 miles down the river, they was barely up on the step, and they came to this non-negotiable turn.
Yeah.
And he reefed her into the sky and flew 50 feet and landed with a tremendous crash in the middle of this pile of stumps. And then the pieces went crashing and sailing and cartwheeling back into the river.
And this guy must have floated down the river a little ways or something.
Boy, he thought he lost a boat. Now, that's my version.
Yeah.
Now, I think the other guy staggered into the airport all skinned up sometime later.
Yeah,
I don't believe the guy that I saw there was close
to. Okay, let me, Jake, you go play now.
Yeah.
Okay, now, next thing. Oh, here's something that you've never said anything about, and all I have to do is have just a superficial description of it, and that was when you married Roberta. In other words, when it was, and I heard somewhere along the grapevine, I think Roberta told me, that you got your skis stuck in the ice on your honeymoon?
Oh, boy.
You gotta have that in there because,
yeah,
man, that's
well,
crazy.
Here's the thing. See, we hired 3 pilots and 1 mechanic. And I always questioned all the pilots to stay away from the inlets and the outlets of these lakes. I said, it's harsh and fun. Anyway, so what happened? We pulled up to this cabin and I thought I was far enough away from the shore, but there was a warm Chinook wind blew that night, and it was the 15th of May, and in spite of the fact that I was far enough away from the shore, the ice lost its tensile strength. So I noticed this deterioration of the ice the next morning, and I very gingerly stepped in the plane, started it up and packed it about 10 feet, and the thing fell through the ice. But I didn't damage anything.
Yeah.
I just started it up and it started to sink, so I shut it down and it landed with the crosswise and didn't do any damage.
Oh,
yeah.
That was the first night of your honeymoon?
Yeah.
What now? What year was it?
May 15th. 64.
Okay. Where was it? Where was the cabin?
About 25 miles.
Was it on some lake?
Nice lake, yeah. Swamp lake.
Swamp lake.
But the thing was, 2 of the guys flying for us, I call them on the radio. Had a gal running on a big radio in the office. All of a sudden, the handle of the chain was, the plane fell through the ice. There they came, and they dropped a box of Wheaties and said that the ice looked too thin to land on and I could walk out.
Keep you going until you got out.
Yeah. Right. So anyway,
hey, there'd be a great title for the chapter right there. The guy wrote that up and has that as a centerpiece in the chapter.
So anyway, I was wild. And so they disappeared and went away. And they came back in about a half hour and landed with blocks and tackles and everything.
How many guys did you have working for you? These were actually...
At one time, I bought the bulk plant in Calpena. That was the 40,000 gallon Union Oil bulk plant. I had 6 airplanes flying at once, and I had 2 riverboats going at once. And I had a Tasty Freeze ice cream stand. One day I made $47.25 trying to mow the front lawn. I got a run on this Tasty ice cream freeze, and Roberta landed in the middle of that rat race. This tremendous Chinese fire drill with everything happening at once. You can't imagine. See, we was trying to run it with a tight force. You'd have one guy running the ice cream stand and river boats. Well, that would put him miles apart from the ice cream stand. Or somebody trying to, I would try to fly all these airplanes and work on them and license them. And then once in a while, I'd get weathered in up on McKinley.
This was all in the mid-60s.
Yeah. And finally, Roberta said, wait a minute. She said, we're hiring all these people and we're doing all these different things. What part of it do you want to keep? Do you want to junk the airplanes and keep the ice cream stand, or do you want to get rid of the bulk plant, or do you want to buy more river boats, or just what do you want to do?
Yeah.
And I said, listen, you got a point there. Let's just get rid of it all and keep the airplane.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Where'd you meet Roberta?
Oh, I knew her for years.
Yeah, I assumed that you had. When did you meet Bob Reed?
Well,
as a matter of fact,
the summer of 40. Over on in McGrath. He was flying this old Boeing tri-motor over there, hauling freight. And I'd seen the plane.
Summer of 40. That would have been when you were working on the airstrip.
Yeah. Well, we...
Just before you flew out of there.
Farewell in... Old Farewell started in 40. McGrath started in 41. Ruby. I worked at Ruby.
Ruby before McGrath.
Yeah.
And then from McGrath, you went back to Anchorage and into the Air Corps. From there.
No. I went to work at Eklutna and in 39, worked the fall, this summer, a couple of months, remember? The mine episode. My partner and I were going to go directly out.
Floated the river.
Well, here. The fall of 39, they started the Calcutta 4,000 foot runway. So after the mining season, just a smidgen, we worked there.
Right.
Okay. But anyway.
And then that was the winter you went to university.
No. Wait a minute. We're getting the thing screwed up by 1 year. That was, let's see, it was 40, almost 40, because Kripke, I worked over at Kripke's mine the following year. Wait a minute, we're getting the Yukon deal. Let me get it straight. See, we know it's 39 for Jenkins.
Right.
Right. Wait a minute, it was 40 for Mike Kripke's Dutch Creek. So it had
to be in the winter.
Wait a minute. It had to be McGrath in 41. It was. It had to be. It had to be McGrath in 41, and that's where I met, ran into the old Boeing. I'd seen it flying out of Maryland.
Okay, so 39 during the summer.
Yeah.
You worked for Jenkins.
Right.
And in the winter of 39, fall of 39.
Well, in the fall of 39, I went on a big big circuit to visit everybody that I, all of the relatives, stateside.
Right.
Then I said, wait a minute. I blew this summer stake in and had a great time, visited all the relatives and went to California and everywhere. Mm-hmm. But I said, this is a fun way to spend that. Hard-earned summer stakes. So then I said, in the fall of 40, after I finished this Kripke's mine operation, then I'll go. That was the fall of 40 I'm coming up to. Up to Fairbanks here.
Fall of 40.
Yeah, that's the way it was.
Okay, and then fall of 40, and then the next year, next summer, spring and summer,
and then
you floated the river.
May 4th.
That's when you took off down,
41,
down the river.
May 4th, 41, exactly. I checked the ice pool breakup. That's
okay. And then that you ended up at Ruby and eventually
Ruby
McGrath.
And then to McGrath.
Then you
then
met Bob.
Farewell.
Reed.
Well, I'd seen him, but I helped unload freight out of his old Trimore.
Okay, and then after that was all over, then of course we were in the war.
Well,
winter
then,
41.
No, wait a minute. So Clancy, E.I. Clancy, the engineer, kept getting me 6-month deferments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. I've got that in.
Well, yeah, but I didn't want any deferments.
Yeah, right.
I
you wanted to get out.
Getting the Air Corps. Anyway, but there was no way to get out of McGrath, man, unless you took a dog
team
or walk.
Yeah, I've got that all.
Everything's high priority. Anyway, Lars Johnson come into the picture then.
Right.
He'll fix you up, and he fixed me up with a C-47, right?
Flew out, put in a froze to death.
Huh. Yeah,
out.
I took...
I remember that.
What sleep night. But anyway, so that was... That carries us on to 42 then.
Okay, well, that's pretty good. Then I got that. So, you met Bob. Now, when did you meet Roberta? I mean, with...
Oh, in about 60.
60?
Yeah. Okay.
And probably in Anchorage?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
See, at the dinners, and I have some film on my own. And once in a while, they used to keep me hopping. I tried to phase out. But
yeah, I imagine.
But yeah, to go down and to the, 18th of the month, I'm supposed to be angry.
She wants stuff like that.
medical profession want to see some pictures. It's a real, I should have brought up that role of the dolphin team in Japan. Because that's a good
one. I'd you like to go out Johnny Carson show, sir?
Oh, no. I that's a waste of time.
Not if we're selling a book, it isn't. Not
no,
if
no.
we're selling a book, it isn't.
No.
No, listen, the reason I ask is this. This is, you know, like at this point of the, this stage of the game, this is truly pie in the sky.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is this. We are going to reach the point after this book comes out where we're going to have to promote it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean,
oh, yeah.
Okay.
Well, listen,
now, that don't mean we're going to have to promote it personally. But the thing is, I know Hugh Downs.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of Hugh Downs? He used to have the Today Show. He's a television personality type. Okay, anyway, I have a feeling that if this book is reasonably successful, I think that I can, if I put my mind to it, I think that I can get the thing set up so that we can put in 10 or 15 minutes on one of the Tonight Shows. They'll fly us there and fly us back.
Oh, yeah.
And all we got to do is sit there, and if you got a segment of, say, 2 or 3 minutes of movies of mountain flying, and tell them about the book. That's it. That's all he wants.
I'd be all right.
We could sell a lot of books.
Gee, yeah.
Just tremendous advertising.
Yeah, but
you know what he gets for a minute
really
of advertising on that thing? Something like $25,000 a minute.
Yeah.
Just to advertise a pair of socks on that show.
Yeah. Johnny Carson, yeah.
Yeah.
Listen,
and they tape it, you know. It's
tape
in the afternoon.
But
no
I
big
think
thing.
If you really wrap her up, it'll do it on her own merit. Hopefully.
But they don't. I tell you, even these big books like what's his name is writing a big book now, just finished writing this book. You'd be surprised. They had the guy that wrote Jonathan Livingston Seagull on there about a month after he wrote it. You bet. Bach was on there. And,
it might be on
this guy advertising show. Once it catches fire, then you got it made. Then you can sit back and let the thing sell itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, I just thought of that, you know, when you were mentioning these films.
Listen,
okay.
But, there's, you know, as I said, there was this for a while. It was about 10 years of this old adventure, high adventure stuff.
Yeah.
Boy, there's a lot of good stuff shot up in the mountains.
You've got some good pictures of you landing up there on the glaciers and all this good stuff.
Oh,
you got some, yeah, sure.
Well, these were television shows.
Yeah.
They
can get the tapes on
those. Old adventure, dry adventure, and all those deals.
Good. Okay.
Yeah, but this is all television tape, see?
No,
I say, for some of these primeval places, there's opportunities. Like this dolphin show.
Yeah.
Man,
yeah, right.
That's a knockout.
Oh, sure. Sure.
The scenery and everything.
Boy.
Natural setting. It's got ancillary rights you're talking
about.
It's got possibility.
Yeah, right. Okay, that's the next thing here. Okay. There was a discrepancy, not necessarily discrepancy, but when you were describing your work with Washburn, we would talk about, I knew that you were working with Washburn from 51 through 60.
Well, it was 59, because the map
59.
Came out in 60.
Okay, right, but I mean, that was when the map came out in 60.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Now, when you were talking about your work with Washburn, you'd mentioned that you were continually. I got the impression that you were continually busy with him all that whole period.
Okay.
This I just wanted to make sure that this was correct. That's why I interpreted.
He had to. Adams Carter is scientific brains,
right.
And he was on some of the survey projects. And what they would do would be put a team in an area that they hadn't surveyed.
Right.
And
I mean on the basis of years.
Well,
Washburn's tapes claim, he says that you didn't.
Segments throughout the years.
He wasn't even in Alaska between 51 and 53, or 54.
Well, just the segments.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know,
but when they get up ahead of steam, then
55 you worked with him a lot.
Well, yeah, but there was thick and thin.
Yeah. Okay. That's all. I just wanted to make sure that I had interpreted
it
right.
No, it wouldn't be as.
Maybe he forgot something.
8 hours a day.
Yeah.
24 months sure. a year deal.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now let's see. Okay, the first two or three chapters we're going to talk about after a while. Oh, one time when we were talking, and I think I've got this on tape someplace. You mentioned this episode. In fact, I'm sure I've got it on tape. You mentioned this episode where you scattered this woman's ashes.
Yeah.
From altitude, and you run into problems with the thing blowing around in the hole in the cabin. What I wanted to ask you was, how often are you requested to do that?
I've got one or two of them stacked up in the back waiting to go now.
In the back of the airplane?
No. In the wolf house in our warehouse back there.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I suppose.
What would you say on an average year?
Well, probably. I suppose every 4 or 5 months you
can use
the
right.
Oh, yeah.
Well, who are these people mainly?
Well,
they have to be climbers.
Look, you're absolutely right. Grace Vinson Holman, Dr. Grace Vinson Holman, was the leader of the Denali Damsels, the first all-girl team that climbed McKinley. And she was involved in a fatal avalanche accident, as was Hans Vanderlaan, an engineer. And a
I think I've got this on tape.
Yeah, well, all right, but this is just to give you an example of who wants their ashes scattered.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Anyway, unbeknown to me, she was always really sharp-tongued and a severe gal, really severe. I didn't ever think that she'd want me to scatter her ashes. I'd have thought, although I hauled her every place she went.
Yeah, right.
But
not the type you'd like to spend the evening
did the sentiment
in the breeze with.
That was one of her requests in her will, that she scattered on McKinley, only it happened a lot sooner than she figured.
That was, right.
Because they...
Was that the one that blew all over the cabin?
No. That had been years or so.
That one will be anonymous, obviously. In fact, I may not even mention it. I'd like to, though.
Well,
because that's...
Here's the thing. Roberta said, how can you stand out in that office, the mountaineers we talk about?
Yeah.
They say, what about Bouillard, the famous pathologist? We heard that you were on the outside.
Yeah.
I explain it, and Roberta is behind the door ready to kill me.
Well, Jesus, you got to get him down off
this
of there.
This is... Sure. Is hypocrisy.
No.
To defile a fine person like Dr. Bouillard, I say, these guys want to know what happened and how I'd ever get a man that
big. That's right. Listen, Bouillard probably be tickled pink that you flew him off the mountain and tied on your airplane.
But the thing is,
how else are you going to get him down? You can't wish him down.
But you can't overlook all his feelings, there is.
Yeah,
I suppose. You don't tell the rough and the tough.
Well, do his relatives know how you got him down off the mountain?
I want to tell you that every 15 minutes on the hour, 24 hours a day, we had a phone call or a wire.
Yeah, so they know.
They didn't care how I got him
right.
out, just so I got him extracted.
There's the answer.
And boy, that... and that.
But you know, down in this book, a guy can't soft foot it too much. In other words, you've got to call a spade a spade,
because
or she ain't going to have the old punch. That's right.
Farm on every takeoff.
Right,
you're not
right,
going to
soft pedal. Right.
The fact that you're going to bust your fanny.
That's right.
On every takeoff.
Exactly.
You've got to get in there and give her full try.
Exactly. So I'm going to write it that
kind
way.
Kind of a deal.
What I'll do, it this way. I won't even ask you who the person was that blew all over the cockpit of the plane.
Yeah.
But I'll mention it, and I'll mention it this way. I'll say that you had been increasingly receiving requests to do this. And you decided to accept one, and then
this was the first one I'd had.
Okay, that's what I'm saying. The first one that you did.
No.
First one you were accepted.
No.
First request you had.
The first request was the ash job all over the cockpit. I was just getting checked out on how not to do it.
Yeah.
See,
okay.
No, I hadn't had any requests prior to that. As a matter of fact, I called my lawyer. I here from a fella. He called up and he said he wanted his wife taken to a high altitude of McKinley.
Hold it down. No, she's still running.
And I said, well, does she have a climbing permit? And the voice on the other end of the phone said she don't need a climbing permit. She's cremated in a small box, like a cigar box. Well,
yeah.
I said, send her up. So I said to McKinley, this is great. Now, the request was that she be scattered to the four winds.
Yeah.
Now, you have to be pretty high if you're going to get scattered to the four winds.
Just four winds blow.
You would go to the four sides of the mountain and scatter a little here and there. But, okay, so I said, McCutcheon, now, tell me, can you think anything that would be a legal obstacle on this type of an operation since I... the first request, and I'm going to carry it out.
Yeah.
And I'll do it on a flight in the area, and I won't have to build up people to fight. Well, he said, fine. He said, read me the serial number on that cigar box. It isn't a cigar box.
Yeah, right.
It's about yay big and about that big. Okay, so he said, well, he said, you know, he put in the apprenticeship as an undertaker. He said that
he was an anchorage attorney.
Yeah. He said, well, look, he said, that's a bona fide number. He said that came from the West Coast, and he knew it just like that.
So
the number of the crematorium was the West Coast number, and he said that's a bona fide number. Well, and not a backyard job.
Yeah.
There's a possibility of being a backyard job.
Sure.
Well, so The thing that impressed me was that I am here at 14,500 feet roaring around in one hell of a turbulent wind.
Yeah.
And I figured it would be ideal to scatter the ashes.
Yeah.
So I reached over, opened the window, took the lid off the sport, and just about half asphyxiated myself with ashes in my hair, all over the cockpit.
God.
You couldn't see in my eyes. In your nose, and the most disgusting thing was this big chunk of bone in the bottom of the box, big enough for a dog to chew on.
But better not put that in there.
Well, I'm telling you.
Yeah, right.
What was, because I'm feeling very in a position where I will do humanity a service by carrying out the last wish, and I'm more or less mourning this poor person that went to a crematorium and all and died and everything, and it's got a very
strong,
big, piecey type air to it until I come to the dog that the dog bone in the bottom of the box. You see? And that took the flavor out of the whole deal.
Yeah.
When I run into the bone.
So, you got that done, but then after that, you have these number, when we one every 6 months of requests.
Well, yeah.
And you've done this
at odd intervals.
How do you do it now, Doc?
I take the lid off after the package is outside the airplane.
You hold it outside the airplane.
Yeah, man. There's no way.
So you're
ever going to get the lid off
the
inside of the airplane
out
and take the package to the outside of the airplane.
What kind of an airplane was it? That first one, the 180. The first one that you've done.
Okay. But don't second guess.
Oh, no.
I'd ask me.
Yeah, right. Well, that's why I got all this stuff on here, see, because I haven't written about that at all yet. I haven't come to that yet. Okay. Now, this is going to be a tough one, I suppose, in a way. It's hard. What I'd like to do as I go along through this whole thing is sort of keep pace with the type of airplanes you use.
Well, basically, they are all the same.
Right, Cubs and 180s. I mean, now, for instance, on that Devil's Canyon thing, you used an Araka sedan.
Yeah, right.
And
that was a boat.
Yeah, right. Now, I assumed that you were using that because it was the only plane you had on floats at the time.
Right.
That was the way I wrote it up.
Right.
Okay. But now, when did you get your first Super Cub?
Well, I owned a fleet of Cubs.
Right, I
know. In 49, the 105 Cub came out, so I bought two of them.
Bought two of them.
Yeah. and 49.50. And then they started to go from the 108 engine to the 125 and 135.
When did you get your first 125?
Yeah, and the number on it was 1924.
That was the first 125 horsepower.
Yeah, that was 51.
And how about the first 150 horsepower?
Well, in about 53, I got for 135, and in 55, I bought two 150s. So they come out 55.
Yeah. Okay.
But I'll put the sheet country. Found out an interesting operational problem, and that was that it was a big job to land the new 150s where you can land the 105s.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Higher airspeed.
Now heavier. Heavier.
They did. They beefed the airframe up that much.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, this is another thing that I don't have on here. What did that Aranca weigh empty, approximately?
On floats, that should have went about 1,300.
I was going to guess 1,250, but I didn't. Yeah. I just left it blank.
Well, that would be interesting.
Well, the reason I mentioned it in the story was because you were obviously watching weight when you were floating in that in that river. Shape.
Well, it was an underpowered airplane.
Anyway. Right. So, you know, I bring that stuff in there because it's kind of interesting.
While you can turn around and stay home.
Okay. When did you get your first 180?
Well, in 53, the 180s came out, but I was skeptical. So I bought five 170 Cessnas with one standard and four with the old